Okay, Anne?
Yes?
Okay.
Hello?
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, great.
Okay. Have any of you ever felt like you were the only person in the world with problems in your life? If so, you might find comfort in the following books that feature teenagers, just like you, all dealing with serious life issues. Imagine having your entire identity erased. Your name, your appearance, and your friends are all of the past. You are now in the federal government's witness protection program. In the book, Zack Fly by Roland Smith, main character Jack Osborne learns that his father, a private pilot, has been involved in drug trafficking with dangerous drug lords. He, along with his mother and sister, are now the targets of revenge. In order for them to remain safe, they must assume new identities in a new location. Guided by FBI agents, he and his family move to a small town in Nevada, where they struggle to adjust to their new lives. The only remnants of their previous identities lie in Jack's journal, but after his journal disappears, how long will it take before their lives are once again in danger? Kate Malone, high school senior, straight-A student, and preacher's daughter, is confident that she will be going to MIT for college next year. So confident, in fact, that MIT is the only school she even applied to. However, when she is rejected, her perfect world begins to collapse. On top of that, Terry Litch, the school freak's house, burns down, and Kate's father has offered Terry, her mother, and her baby brother a place to stay. Just as Kate begins to adjust to living with Terry's family, tragedy strikes. In Lori Hulse Anderson's Catalyst, secrets are revealed that cause Kate's outlook on the world to be changed forever. Most of you have probably seen the painting Girl with a Pearl Earring by the artist Vermeer. The painting depicts a teenage girl, probably no older than most people in this audience, gazing directly at the viewer and wearing a large pearl earring. Tracy Chevalier's book, also titled Girl with a Pearl Earring, successfully attempts to create a story behind the girl in the painting. In her book, the girl's name is Greet. After Greet's father, a tile maker, is blinded by a kiln explosion, she is forced into servitude in order to provide a meager income for her family. She is employed in the household of the famous artist Vermeer and quickly becomes his assistant. Lust, deceit, and jealousy are all components of Greet and Vermeer's relationship in this intriguing novel. Stanley Yelnats has terrible luck. After being mistaken for a criminal in a crime he didn't commit, he is given the option to go to jail or to Camp Green Lake. He chooses Camp Green Lake, but upon arrival realizes that it is not at all what he expected. For one thing, there's no lake. Instead, there's a dry lake bed that he and fellow campmates are expected to dig 5 feet deep holes in every day. Because according to the camp counselors, if you take a bad boy and make him dig a hole every day in the hot sun, it will turn him into a good boy. However, it is not long before Stanley begins to figure out that their digging serves a purpose far more beneficial to Camp Green Lake than he could ever imagine. If you like books with surprising twists at their endings, be sure to read Holes by Lewis Sacker. Bobby Morris was just like any other 16-year-old boy. He liked to hang out with his friends, play basketball, and spend time with his girlfriend. Then, his life suddenly changed when he learned that his girlfriend, Mia, was pregnant. Jump into the future, and Bobby is raising his baby daughter, Feather, by himself. Join Bobby as he struggles with the problems of being a single teenage father in Angela Johnson's The First Part Last. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Okay. And we have caller again. And I believe this should be Sherry Remington. Yep. And this should be Sherry.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Ready whenever you are.
All right. I am ready.
Great.
Have you ever found yourself looking for books that don't take forever to read? Then the following books might interest you. Each of them's a quick read, but they don't look like they're short. As an extreme example, there's Crank by Ellen Hopkins. It's 537 pages long, but I know someone who read it in 3 hours. So imagine how fast you could read Cynthia Rylant's God Went to Beauty School with only 56 pages, or Boris with 74 pages. And now let me tell you about a couple more books. Steffi does not know where to go when she finds herself pregnant and unsure she's still welcome at home. Dante is living in a foster home where the rules are so rigid he's not getting enough to eat and finds himself locked out of the house one night. Carmen has been arrested for DUI, and her grandmother does not come to take her home. Harris is disowned by his father when he tells his dad that he's gay. Katie has to leave home to escape her mother's abusive boyfriend. These are some of the people who find their way to Keisha's house. And Keisha, she has a story of her own in Keisha's House by Helen Frost. Imagine you've just gone to visit your married sister. Your parents and your brother are with you. And all of a sudden, there's this loud banging on the door, and this wigged-out man carrying a machete slashes his way into the house as your father yells for you, your mother, and your sister to barricade yourselves in the upstairs bedroom while he and your brother fight off the intruder. But something goes very wrong. Everything goes silent downstairs. And then the deranged man is bludgeoning his way into the room where you're hiding. As the man breaks in, he shatters the stained glass window in the room. Splintering by Aaron Corrigan is about this night and the ones that follow it. Sister Slam, No Crap, used to be Laura Rose Crapper. But when she graduated high school, she packed her bags, grabbed her goth friend Twig, and they hit the road in her rabbit turd green 69 Firebird. They were off to slam poetry in Tin Can, New Jersey, and anywhere else they could find to sling words. This is how Sister Slam and the Poetic Motormouth Road Trip by Linda Oatman High begins. Their trip's anything but smooth, what was starting right out hitting a pig, then insulting someone they later learned to regret insulting. But it also has its good moments, like meeting a really hot guy who rescues them from a sticky situation and helps them to find the silver lining in their rain clouds. Hey, batter, hey, batter. Man on first. Man on second. Kevin Bowen is up to bat. He's the cleanup man. Fouls one. Takes a strike. Then hits a solid double right over the pitcher's head. Two runs score, and Kevin is standing safe on second. That was before he came down with mono and had to lay low at home. In Shakespeare Bats Cleanup by Ron Kirchie, this is when Kevin learns how it's possible for Shakespeare to bat cleanup. What happens to send a man, a seemingly harmless man, over the edge? It all started out as a normal day in June. It's the end of the school year. Everyone's picking up their yearbooks and basically going about their business as usual. But after lunch, as students enter room 114, they know that something's gone wrong. Terribly wrong. Author Mel Glenn allows the reader a glimpse into each student's thoughts, as well as the hostage takers, in The Taking of Room 114, a hostage drama in poems. And now here are a few quick picks. Loose Threads by Laurie Ann Grover, about losing someone to cancer. Love, Ghosts, and Facial Hair by Stephen Herrick, about first love. 17 by Liz Rosenberg, about first love, again. What Mother Doesn't Know by Sonia Sones, about love number one, number two, and also number three, sounds like a theme. Girl Coming in for a Landing by April Halperin Whalen, about 1 year in a young girl's life, and First Love. Jinx by Margaret Wilde, about a girl's journey out of despair after first love. And that wraps it up.
Thank you very much, Sherry. If we could change the order of the last three. And Jennifer, if you would go ahead and give us a call.
I'm here.
Okay. And then followed by Julie, if you would go ahead and give us a call. And then let's do the group last, okay? Okay, Jennifer?
Yes.
Ready?
I sure am.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Straight from the hard case crime files. Jake had a pretty good life, or so it appeared on the outside. He was married to a college professor, his career was going well, and his personal life was going well. But some people have a knack for finding trouble. They just don't know how to be happy. His mistress turns up dead, and he becomes a prime suspect. That is, until his wife's newly discovered boyfriend, Minor, enters the picture. Jake's life, as he knew it, including his marriage, was falling apart. In an effort to save it, he begins investigating the murder himself. He starts taking a closer look at the new boyfriend. Jake and Minor have a lot in common. Their looks, including their hair color and their physical build, the same clothing style. They have similar jobs, both working in the field of law. Jake, a forensic psychologist, and Minor, a prosecuting attorney. And now they have similar tastes in women as well. Could this be a setup? The question becomes, who framed who in The Confession? The Confession by Dominic Stansberry. Although Roy was an ex-boxer, he tried to become a stand-up kind of guy and live a clean life. After all, he came to L.A. to be a screenwriter, not a boxer or even a roofer. But working on a roof was exactly what he was doing when Rebecca came looking for Roy that day. She wanted his help, and she was willing to pay for it. He almost turned her down, but the cash sounded nice. Roy knew the roofing job was over and the money was going to stop coming in, and that his desk drawer at home was full of ideas and not actual screenplays. Besides, how could he resist the damsel in distress? He promised to save her from a vengeful mobster. He just didn't know he had to join the mob to do it. Of course, he had spent Rebecca's money right away, catching up on late rent and overdue car payments. And when things took a turn down a path he wasn't sure he wanted to follow, he had to stick it out because he didn't have the money to give back to Rebecca. Plus, he wasn't a quitter. Was Rebecca really a jilted girlfriend fearing for her life at the hands of an ex-boyfriend? Or was she writing her own screenplay, Fade to Blonde, and casting herself as the main character? Fade to Blonde by Max Phillips. Dave and Vince told the Big City Reporter about all of the unsolved mysteries on the island, or so Stephanie had thought. She was an intern working with them at the Weekly Islander, and she knew they had left something out of the conversation with the Globe reporter. They were holding on to a 20-year-old unsolved case. The body that was found by two high school students running before school didn't have any identification. As far as the officials were concerned, the death of this man was an accident, so case closed. But there were too many baffling circumstances of his death just to stop there and say it was an accident. After all, they didn't even know who he was or where he came from. Dave and Vince were the only ones still around from when the incident took place, and they kept the case alive. It took over a year before the body was even identified as the Colorado Kid, and that was only due to the efforts of a graduate student in forensics. Once they had an identity on the man, they worked to piece together what happened up until his death. There were just too many weird things that didn't add up. For example, why would he have chartered a plane from Boulder to Maine? A charter was the only explanation. Flying commercial wouldn't have given him enough time to catch the last ferry to the island and to eat dinner in one of the local restaurants before his time of death, as established by the medical examiner. Was it an impossible crime or something stranger? The Colorado Kid by Stephen King. It's amazing at how your life can change so quickly. That's exactly what John Blake thought. A week ago, he had no clue he would become caught up in the life of his first serious girlfriend, Miranda. They broke up not long after starting their freshman year in college. Long-distance relationships were just too hard. After the breakup, John assumed he would never see Miranda again. Only now he was. But it was a picture in the paper, and the headline announced her murder. Luckily, John had become a private investigator, so it was only natural for him to want to get involved. So he set out to look for the truth behind Miranda's murder. Many cuts and bruises, a concussion, another murder, and an attempted murder later, John thought he had it all figured out. My, how his Miranda had changed so much since they went their separate ways. Could the murder victim really be Miranda? What had happened to Miranda and her college roommate Jocelyn? John figured if he could find Jocelyn, he could find some answers. He thought he found her, but did that help his case or hurt it? Eerie, too, the way Miranda and Jocelyn looked so much alike. Was Miranda really the little girl lost? Little Girl Lost by Richard Alias. Read about The Confession, Fade to Blonde, The Colorado Kid, Little Girl Lost, and other mysteries in the Hard Case Crime series.
Nice job. Okay, we have two more. We have a group, Sherry, Jeanette, and Janelle, and we have Julie Schwartz. And we'll take the first one that calls in. And we're waiting for the light to light up one more time in this year. This will be our last LIS webcast for the year, I believe. Yes, I think so. I think this is a wrap for us. And we will start programming again around January 15th of 2006, when we'll start the first Tuesdays, a new series of first Tuesdays, at this same URL. Information will go up mid-January about some of the things that are coming up. Julie Schwartz has called in. Julie, how'd you like to do your book talk for us?
I would love to. Okay.
Good.
Well, I'm going to start out with a couple of really bad jokes. First one is, what's a pirate's favorite part of the house? The yard.
Okay.
What's a pirate's favorite mode of transportation?
Yard arm.
A car.
Car. They are really bad.
Yeah, I told you they were really bad. I could go on.
That's okay.
A million, but I'll spare you, don't worry.
Okay.
When you think of a pirate, what do you picture? A grizzled old guy with an eye patch, a wooden leg, and a parrot on his shoulder? Someone who says "arr" a lot and calls people scurvy dogs? The swashbuckling sailors I'm going to introduce you to today don't exactly fit the description. They have all of their limbs, can see out of both eyes, and, well, they're girls. At the age of 8, Mary Faber is orphaned and left penniless to fend for herself as one of Rooster Charlie's gang of begging, thieving street urchins on the mean streets of London. To escape an almost certain fate in the gallows or the brothels, 12-year-old Mary disguises herself as a boy, christens herself Jack, and signs on as a ship's boy on the HMS Dolphin. In the first of many battles between the dolphin and pirate ship, Jackie shoots a pirate, and the other sailors soon christen her Bloody Jack. Though she quickly learns the ropes of life at sea, Jackie finds it harder and harder to keep up the deception that she is a boy. To complicate matters, she finds herself falling head over heels in love with a fellow ship's boy. A boy that she happens to share a hammock with every night. A boy who, rather unfortunately, thinks she's a boy. Things get a little awkward. The book is Bloody Jack, the first of the Bloody Jack Adventures by L.A. Meyer. Now, I promise I won't be giving away too much when I tell you that by the end of the first book, Jackie's jig is up. She is discovered to be a girl and dropped off in Boston, where the captain uses Jackie's earnings to enroll her at the Lawson Peabody School for Young Girls. Curse of the Blue Tattoo chronicles Jackie's life in Boston, where you can bet that, despite her best efforts, the salty, gutsy sailor girl doesn't quite succeed in becoming a fine lady. Under the Jolly Roger, the third book in the series, finds Jackie sailing the seas once again, but this time held against her will on a British warship with a scurvy captain that's just itching to get her alone in his private cabin. As the only ranking officer on board ship when the captain mercifully kicks the bucket, Jackie becomes the captain herself and soon finds herself exactly where she belongs, in the thick of battle, beloved by her crew and feared by French sailors everywhere as a merciless pirate queen. But Jackie Faber is not the only young girl sailing the seas. You'll find her complete opposite in Charlotte Doyle, the heroine of The True Confessions of Charlotte Doyle by Avi. Charlotte is a fine and proper young lady, and is properly horrified when she finds herself unchaperoned and alone, the only girl aboard a ship with a mutinous crew and a cruel captain. How prim little Charlotte manages to survive her perilous sea journey, despite being accused of murder, found guilty, and sentenced to hang, is a tale you'll have to read for yourself to believe. Rounding out my group of adventurers, seafaring girls, are Nancy Kington and Minerva Sharp of Celia Reese's Pirates. Nancy is the daughter of a Jamaican plantation owner, and Minerva is her slave. You wouldn't think they'd get along very well, but when circumstances force them to flee the island, they become inseparable friends, equals, and rather than pirates. At first, the guy pirates aren't so sure about letting them hitch a ride on the ship, but the girls soon prove their worth. They fight just as fiercely as the men, and turn out to be rather useful in fooling the merchant ships, because a ship with women on board isn't likely to be a pirate ship, right? Okay, I have one more joke before I go.
Okay.
I'll leave you to figure out the punchline.
Oh, thanks.
Oh, what's the pirate's favorite letter of the alphabet?
The pirate's favorite letter of the alphabet. We'll kick that one around. R, 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 R. Great.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Julie.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, and we have another caller. Yep.
This is Sherry Crawford.
Hello, Sherry Crawford.
Hi.
You want to lead off now? Are you all? Is your group going to be calling in series? Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, got it.
All right.
We're ready when you are.
Okay. We all live in the United States, and our culture helps determine who we are. Immigrants to our country come from a variety of different cultures whose societal codes are more defined. In order to understand the clash of cultures, it is important to become aware of the difference between cultural understandings. In the following books, the characters are young people who have to deal with roles placed on them by the societies in which they live. Our group focused on multicultural literature about young adults from three cultures. The setting is significant in my three books that feature African-American young people. The first two books take place in predominantly black urban neighborhoods, and the last one takes place in the California desert. What's up with Delia? She's smart, but she's worried she won't pass the test to get into high school. The reason? She can't read. What's up with Randy? It's just been he and his dad for years. But his dad hasn't returned from his most recent truck driving gig. Randy is running out of food and money. He's a 14-year-old living on his own. What's up with the Tolliver twins? Why are they always so mean and nasty? The whole school is scared of them, especially after they make threatening comments on a Jerry Springer-type television show. And what's up with Yo-Yo? She's always making up stories. Nobody can believe a word that she says. To find out the answers to these questions, read the book Double Dutch, which takes place in an inner-city middle school. These students have their problems and their secrets. What keeps them going is the Double Dutch jump roping contest, and the national finals are coming to their city. There's a budding romance between Randy and Delia, and maybe the Tolliver twins aren't so bad after all. The writer, Sharon Draper, keeps the story moving with her believable dialogue and touches of humor. Your mama jokes and Yo-Yo's far-out stories will make you laugh. The thrill of the Double Dutch contest will keep you reading. Handbook for Boys by Walter Dean Myers sounds like one of those self-help books, and in some ways it is. It's really a novel about Jimmy, who has to work in the neighborhood barbershop, where he and Kevin, another teen lawbreaker, get lots of advice from the store owner, Duke, and the barbershop regulars. Jimmy is reluctant to buy into what Duke and his friends are saying. They're old guys, and what do they know? They tell Jimmy and Kevin all sorts of stories about the barbershop customers. Jimmy starts to see the difference between the people in his poor neighborhood who become successful and those who don't. Duke likes to point out that people aren't always what they seem, and money and popularity don't always bring happiness. Sure, the book gets a little preachy at times, but Jimmy and Kevin seem like real kids. Walter Dean Myers also wrote Fallen Angels and Monsters, but this story isn't big on action like his other books, but it does give us something to think about. In my last book, Ola is the best grandmother that Emmy could ask for. She always is so much fun and lives in the California desert, where she is surrounded by interesting friends. Emmy and her mother are visiting Ola for the last time because Ola has cancer and has to move back to the city with Emmy's family. Emmy decides to make a home video interviewing Ola's friends and family, but she learns more than just Ola's life in the desert. She finds out that her grandfather was murdered by a lynch mob in Alabama during the Civil Rights Movement. This had a profound effect on both Ola and Emmy's mother. It's also where the title of the book, Toning the Sweep, comes from. A sweep is a piece of farm machinery that mourners would hit to make a ringing sound when someone died. The writer Angela Johnson tells a sweet story that shows us how important family ties are. And Jeanette should be waiting to go next.
Okay. Jeanette?
Yes.
This is Jeanette?
Yes, it is.
Okay, and you're going to continue for your group, correct?
Yes, I am. I'm ready.
Okay, great.
Should I go ahead?
You betcha.
Okay. The following three books that I read introduce the reader to Asian cultures, Japan, China, and Korea. The books involve three different Asian cultures, but they are connected by the underlying focus on how the culture is as much a part of the story as the characters involved. Have you ever wished to be a samurai, training to serve your shogun with all the tradition and skill of the Japanese warriors? 14-year-old Sakai has wished this for his whole life, but his father is a tea merchant, and in the 1700s in Japanese society, Sakai is expected to follow in his father's footsteps. When Sakai and his father spend the night at the Takedo Inn on their way to market, a valuable ruby is stolen from another guest, a visiting shogun. Sakai is a witness to the robbery, and his father allows him to serve Judge Uka, who is called to solve the crime. The judge and Sakai follow the trail of a traveling band of actors, suspects in the crime. Judge Uka tests Sakai by sending him off on his own to infiltrate the group of actors. He encounters physical and mental challenges as he seeks to find the real reason for the crime. In the process, he finds honor among thieves, learns to sword fight and the ways of the samurai, and in the end is adopted by the judge to continue his training. The Ghost in the Takedo Inn is the first of Dorothy and Thomas Hubler's samurai series. This historical mystery introduces the reader to the traditions of Japanese society and to the engaging characters of Judge Uka and Sakai. Their relationship benefits both master and servant and solves crime at the same time. Think back to when you were 5 years old and got in trouble. Even at five, you are old enough to know your mind and understand that your disobedience will have consequences. When Aelin was five, she refused to have her feet bound, in the tradition of Chinese upper-class women. She had seen the effects of this practice on her grandmother, mother, and older sister. She understands the pain caused by forcing the toes to bend under the foot and to be bound for life, so she knew she could never run again. When her mother and grandmother attempt to begin the process, she screams and kicks until her father steps in and declares that she does not have to have her feet bound. The consequences of her refusal are far-reaching. Aelin's decision ruins her chances of marrying into a good family and embarrasses her own family. Her father also pays to send her to school, something that very few Chinese girls did in the early part of this century. When he dies, her uncle, now head of the house, refuses to pay for her school, and she leaves home at 14 to find work as a nanny for an American missionary family. Ties That Bind, Ties That Break by Lenzi Namioka shows the determination of a young woman to break traditional barriers against women and to control her own destiny. Aylin earns her way to the United States with the missionary family and establishes her own life. As she finds success and happiness, she wants to write her family in China, so hopefully they can understand her choices and she can make them proud. In my last book, imagine that another country has conquered the United States and we are all forced to change our names to a name in the other country's language. We can only speak that other language and all things American are forbidden. Teaching English, displaying the flag, anything American is cause for arrest and punishment. During World War II, Japan occupied Korea and forced all citizens to adopt the Japanese culture. The Koreans resisted. In When My Name Was Kyoko by Linda Sue Park, Soon-hee and her older brother, Tai Yul, live in fear of the Japanese who control their country. Through quiet resistance, they maintain Korean culture in their home. Their uncle secretly publishes a resistance newspaper. Their father teaches them kanji, which is Korean writing. Their mother hides her jewelry from the Japanese and saves a rose of Sharon tree, which had been ordered destroyed by the Japanese because it symbolized Korea. The story is told through both brother and sister, and the end of World War II is shown through their eyes. Tai Yul volunteers in the Japanese army to protect his family and then trains as a kamikaze pilot. His family does not know if he is alive or dead and can only hope the war will end before he has to give his life in service of a country he despises to preserve his family honor.
In these next three stories, the young adults are struggling to integrate aspects of Hispanic culture, whether Cuban or Mexican, with their own American experience. Do you believe in ghosts? Jesus, also known as Chewy, a 17-year-old from South Fresno, California, hasn't really given it much thought. He's just an average-looking guy wearing cheap plastic shoes he bought at Payless. He's combing his hair in the restroom of the Club Estrella on his way to meet up with Rachel, a girl from English class at school. He turns to the guy next to him and tells him he likes his yellow shoes. Big mistake. Next thing he knows, the guy has wrapped an arm around his neck like a snake, and with his other hand, he's plunged a knife into Chewy's chest. Then the guy sticks the knife in right above Chewy's belly button, then strikes him in the back. Chewy feels his spirit lifting out of his body. He is a ghost now. He starts to float around the city, watching his friends, family, and people in his neighborhood. He sees a homeless guy who's about to die. He sees a thief stealing bicycles from little kids. He also finds his killer. Then he watches as his mom leaves a gun wrapped in a towel on his cousin Eddie's porch. She wants Eddie to get revenge for Chewy's death. Chewy screams at his mom, "No, you can't ask him to do this." But of course she can't hear him. He's a ghost. Gary Soto, in his story, The Afterlife, paints a vivid picture of a soul watching what goes on after his death and learning to accept what his life has meant to the people he loves. Have you ever heard of an event called the Quince on Hierro? If you haven't, you're in the same position as Violet Paz. In Nancy Osa's Cuba 15, Violet is a 15-year-old living a comfortable middle-class life in Chicago. Her mom is Polish and her dad is Cuban. Violet herself is a typical American girl. She doesn't speak Spanish, and she sure doesn't know anything about the Quince on Hierro, the big Now You Are a Woman party for 15-year-old Hispanic girls. But she is about to find out with the help of her abuela and abuelo, her dad's parents, who immigrated from Cuba around the time of Fidel Castro's takeover. She is also consulting a book called Quince on Hierro for the Gringo Dummy. No way is Violet going to have a big fluffy pink dress or a tacky tiara, but she does want to know what this whole Quince thing is all about. She also wants to know more about Cuba. But every time she brings the subject up, her parents just start talking about the way Cuba used to be, and her dad gets really angry. But that's not going to stop Violet, though. She's determined to make her family tell her everything. And for my last book, The Hollywood of Sammy and Juliana in Hollywood by Benjamin Alir Sands is not the fashionable, glitzy California locale you might think of. It's a tough barrio in New Mexico. Sammy loves Juliana, but she's got a seriously messed up family. Sammy's Chicano family consists of his dad, his little sister Elena, and himself. His mom is dead. Sammy himself is a brainy guy, a good student. Sammy says his relationships with teachers consists of asking them what assignments do they want him to do and when do they want them done. In fact, his friends call him the librarian. But even Sammy is getting restless. It's the late 1960s. In other parts of the country, there are riots and demonstrations, but at Sammy's high school, you'd never know it. Guys are getting busted there for not having a belt or for not tucking in their shirts. Sammy can't understand it. His friends are going off to Vietnam or overdosing on drugs, and his school starts to seem totally irrelevant. So he and his friends decide to stage a little demonstration of their own. Sammy also really wants to escape next year to the University of California at Berkeley. But there is trouble at home, and his family needs him now more than ever. So Sammy has to decide, can he or should he leave his father and little sister behind? This concludes our book talks on African American, Asian, and Hispanic American teen literature by Sherry Crawford, G. Motzoff, and myself, Janelle Fallenmoser. Thank you for listening, and good evening.
Thanks, Janelle. Well, congratulations to the entire class. And the tech folks, the engineers are sitting here shaking their heads yes for really a terrific class cast. It was a beautiful job, and we really didn't hit any snags all the way through it. Smooth as silk. Even our technology was cooperative this evening after being a little balky along about 5:30 and causing some panic attacks. Grades for the final draft of the MSU book reviews will go up sometime tomorrow. I'll be working on it during the day. WebCT is being a little bulky, so it may take a little time to get those up. I want to give them one more reading. I intend to put them into a single file and ship them off to Sherry Jones at MSU. You don't need to do anything else to them unless you get an email that says there's a crisis of some kind, and I don't expect that to happen. Grades for the book talks will be posted as soon as the LIS radio engineers get the archives up on LIS radio. I'd like to hear them one more time because I've been sitting here keeping track of what's going on and counting minutes on my fingers. I'd really like to be able to sit down and really concentrate on them and listen to them and give you some good feedback on them. That's a wrap for this evening, Wednesday, 9434. Wait a minute, I'm running into the wrong thing on my paper. That's a wrap for this evening's 9434 Radio Class Cast. We welcome your questions, comments, and suggestions regarding LIS Radio. Just send them to, you can send them to me at esserl@missouri.edu and include LIS Radio in the subject line. This broadcast will be archived on the LIS Radio website at lisradio.missouri.edu. Allow 2 to 3 days for the program to become available. This broadcast will be divided into several files for easier access. My thanks to Jen, Michael, Matt, Clayton for sticking with me this evening. LIS Radio will be taking a break until January 15th of 2006. Check this URL for information on upcoming series and programs in 2006. First Tuesdays will return with a new lineup of guests, and Show Me Libraries will once again showcase exemplary library programs throughout the state of Missouri. See you next year, and enjoy the break.